Hello everybody, welcome to the Android End Puzzle Walkthrough. My name is Tommy MacWilliam, and today we're going to be looking at the first Staff's Choice Android project. So as always, just the URLs for everything. By popular demand, these slides and all the source code we'll be looking at for the walkthrough are already posted at cs76.net/projects, so feel free to follow along as I go through all these source code examples. So today, we're going to talk about the end puzzle, what it is, and how to work with it and solve it. Then dynamic GUIs. So we've been looking at views with XML a lot, so we're going to take a look at doing the same thing in Java today. Then we'll take a look at bitmaps, which we'll be working with to display the background of the end puzzle and all the little images for the tiles, as well as saving state, as the spec requires you save the state whenever the user leaves the activity for the end puzzle. And finally, a quick look at menus, since we haven't seen those yet, but they're required for the project. So as always, I have my feedback page. Feel free to let me know how I'm doing. All right, so for this puzzle, for this project, there's kind of a lot thrown at you at once. So when you attack something like this, you want to have a little bit of a game plan, or what you're going to do in what order. So this is just one of the orders you could do everything in. So the first thing you need to do is take this background image and break it up into smaller tiles. So we haven't gone over anything regarding how to do that, so we'll take a lot of time to look at this today. Next, you might want to implement the gameplay logic. So just swapping tiles with Java, you know, not displaying anything to the user, but maintaining some board state where you can actually swap tiles and maintain like a blank tile in the board. Next, you'll want to connect that gameplay logic to the actual UI, so tiles are actually moving around, as well as in your internal state. Then, after that end puzzle activity is complete, you can move on to the activity before that, which would display a dynamic image selector, where the user can choose the image for their end puzzle. Then after that, you can work on saving and retrieving state, which is kind of unrelated to those two things. And finally, the congratulatory activity that displays when the game is solved. So that's just one order that you can attack everything in, but all of these steps will have to be completed at some point. So the end puzzle, I'm really bad at it, despite having done this for a while. I still can't do it. There's a lot out there. This URL is particularly helpful if you want to learn how to solve it so you can actually debug it. But the puzzle is solved when all of the tiles are in increasing order from left to right, top to bottom. So 1 is in the top left corner, and then the n squared minus 1 tile is in the almost bottom to right corner. So we can't, as we mentioned in lecture, we can't just randomly shuffle tiles to create a solvable end puzzle. So the rule of thumb is just when there's an odd number of tiles, which means there are an even number of rows and columns, you need to swap the last two tiles. So instead of 3, 2, 1, you'll have 3, 1, 2. So although we're going to be displaying images to the user, it's really helpful for us if we associate a number with each tile. We won't actually display this number to the user. Or, you know, while you're debugging, you can work with numbers instead of images. But it's going to be really helpful to maintain the board state if we're keeping track of a numbered tile. So these numbers are going to go from 1 to n squared minus 1, where n is going to be the number of rows and columns on the board. Now, there's also a blank tile, which you need to give some sentinel value. In this case, it's really convenient to just use 0, since 0 is not in 1 n squared minus 1 for any n. But remember, we're not actually going to be displaying these numbers to the users. So before we get into the actual code, this is a good time to just take a quick look at the MVC design pattern. So you might have heard of this before with web apps or even iOS apps, as we'll look at sooner. But the basic idea behind MVC is a division of logic. So you're dividing these three parts of your code into three very separate things. So the first is the model, which is going to be the representation and the storage of your internal data. Next is the view, which is going to be displaying that data to the user. And finally, the controller is kind of the bridge so the view can communicate with the model. So when you're developing iOS apps, this will become very clear as you're working with view controllers and actual models. But this same logic applies to really many problems, including this one. So our model is going to be some internal representation of the board state, while the view is going to be the presentation of tiles themselves. So I mean, you could theoretically not have a model and just keep using, you know, button IDs or searching around in the view, but that's going to be a little bit worse design than using some kind of internal state, and you're going to find it a lot easier if you maintain the state of the board in some Java array or class or whatever it is you want to use. So Java has support for 2D arrays, so if you have a board with n rows and n columns, you can just create an n by n 2D array. remember arrays are a little inflexible in Java in that they're statically sized. So we don't know at the beginning how big our board is going to be, so we can't just add new elements to an array like this. If we want to do that, we're going to need to use something called an ArrayList, which is in the java.util class, which is also available on Android. So this is nice because we can dynamically size things. However, this is going to consume a little bit more memory, and getting and setting elements is a bit more verbose. So there's just a trade-off between both this ArrayList and array thing. You also might stumble upon something called java.util.vector, which looks like it does everything that the ArrayList does. Just know that it's a little slower because the vector is called synchronized. So it's designed to handle multiple threads at once. So because it's synchronized, it's going to slow down your get and set operations. So the question is, why is array typed as an integer? So you don't have to use an integer. In this case, you could say that the value of board ij is equal to the number of the tile. You could also have an array of buttons. This was just kind of a syntactic reminder of how to do this in Java. But we could feasibly use an integer if we're associating a number with every tile.
Maybe I didn't ask that question the right way.
Sure.
Why is board not typed as array? Why is it typed as? I'm not familiar with Java syntax, so in other languages, I thought that if you had an array, it would be type of array.
Oh, sure. So this is just kind of Java syntactic sugar for declaring an array. So we just this is how we would access a 2D array. So a single dimension array, you just use one set of brackets like that. With a two-dimensional array, you just use two sets of brackets. So this is just kind of a reminder of what array syntax looks like.
Could you only store ints in that array?
We can only store ints in this array. So it's an array of integers. If you have an array list, you'll also have a type associated with that array list.
So if you said button board and then that would be a double array of buttons, a two-dimensional array of buttons.
Yes, if we replace this int with a button, then we would have an array of buttons.
Gotcha.
So in an array like this, everything is the same type, unlike JavaScript, which was...
And where have you declared the size in this?
So this we haven't declared the size. This isn't like valid Java syntax. This is just like an example. So this has no size. If we were declaring an array, we would give it a fixed size like 3.3 or 5.5, but this has no size. You would put that in between those brackets. Okay, so the basics of manipulating the puzzle. So we need to be able to swap tiles, basically, only when a tile is next to the blank tile. So when you tap on a tile, that tile and the position of the blank tile should swap places. Now, this sounds simple, but remember, there are a lot of corner cases. So if someone taps a tile that's not next to a blank tile, your board shouldn't do anything. But you need to also consider on a mobile device something like tapping two tiles at once. You know, if the blank is in the middle of the board and we tap every tile that's next to the board, we need to make sure that your app doesn't get into some illegal state. You also need to consider things like, what if I'm holding down a tile or I flick my finger across the screen or anything random like that. So a really good way to test for these corner cases is to use this utility called Monkey that we looked at. So if we fire up the ADB shell and run Monkey, this program can add in some random UI interactions. So if you just let Monkey try to tap all your different buttons, and you can see that, okay, maybe a switch shouldn't have happened, or now my board's in some illegal state, that's a lot faster than trying to click them all yourself. So just when you're designing your swaps, it seems pretty simple, but just make sure that there is no way that we can ever make an illegal swap or get your board into some illegal state, no matter what we do to your phone. Yeah?
It looks like that in the demo that he gave with Monkey, it all happens really quick. Is there a way to go back exactly what it did to get it into that illegal state, if it did get it into one?
Right. So the question was, you know, how can we better use Monkey to kind of log what it did or kind of tell it what to do? And there's an entire documentation page devoted to all the different things Monkey could do. You just basically pass it different flags, and it'll output different things. So that's on the developer.android.com, and you'll see, like, a Monkey page. Yep.
Since quite a few of us don't have an actual Android device and just rely on the emulator, how can we program for tapping two tiles at once or holding down a tile?
So there is a way to simulate kind of a gesture on the emulator. I'm drawing a blank offhand, but I'll look it up right afterwards and let you know. But there is a way to simulate like two fingers on the emulator at once. Yep.
So I see here view is a base class for widgets, but is a view a resource? How do you go about creating views?
So the question was, is a view a resource? So a view is a class that's going to, of which buttons are subclasses. So widget, it's officially part of the widget package, but effectively buttons are subclasses of views. So that was just, the word view there is just, you know, some GUI element. You know, however you choose to represent a bitmap on your device, which we'll take a look at how to do. OK. So there are many different ways to actually display the puzzle. So you could have a linear layout composed of linear layouts, right? So if you have a linear layout with a vertical orientation, and inside of that you have three linear layouts with a horizontal orientation, then you just created three rows on top of each other. So you can size that accordingly. You could also use a table layout, which is kind of designed for this. And you can have table rows and table columns, and then you can create the appropriately sized board. So within all of these layouts is where you're going to be putting your elements. And so those are a couple of ways to position them. So once we have the elements on the device, we need to make sure we attach event handlers to them. Whether we're attaching event handlers to an image view or attaching event handlers to a layout, it's up to you. But you just need to make sure that these elements that are placed onto the device are able to respond to taps. So that's with the set on click listener, which we'll take a look at shortly.
You just used the word element there. What did you mean?
I use the word element like any GUI element, meaning like an image view or a view. So just element like a GUI thing. Yeah. So we've been looking at GUIs and layouts primarily using XML so far. And that's because all of our layouts have been largely static. Before the program is run or before the app is run, we already know what the layout should look like. In this case, we don't know precisely what the layout should look like at compile time because we're allowing the user to select an easy, medium, or hard difficulty. So we can't just hard code in three linear layouts if the user is able to select five. So to do that, we can code our GUI using Java. So in order to do so, we first need to make sure that we're importing the correct packages. So in XML, we can just create a button element. But if we just try to create a button object in Java without using this import statement, Java's going to complain because it has no idea what a button is. So if you've used something like C++ and you have that include statement, this is the Java equivalent. You're just telling the compiler that there is some class called button, it exists, and that you should compile with it. So you can use this wildcard thing here, this star at the end, to automatically import all of the packages within this widget package. So there's something like import android.widget.button. You can also do android.widget.editText or any of the other things we've been looking at. Now, if you put this star here, it's automatically going to import everything. So this will actually put a small hit on your compiler, so it'll compile a little slower. So best practice is to just import only what you need via import android.widget.button or whatever it is you need to use. So in XML, we have a really simple GUI here. We just have a button within a layout. Nothing has any attributes. To do this in Java, we need to create a new linear layout object. Now, all of these constructors take one argument, and that's going to be the context. So in most cases, you can just pass it this, which is going to be the current instance of your activity. So here, we're creating a layout and a button object. And now we're calling this addView method on layout, which is going to say that this button object is going to be a child of the linear layout. So when we're dynamically creating these GUIs, this r.id thing no longer helps us. So this class is automatically generated by Eclipse, remember. And Eclipse does that by looking at your XML and then creating this file. So obviously, Eclipse can't do that anymore. So in order to set the ID of an element, we can just call the setID method. So I just have this view here. So this could be anything, really. So if we had a button called button, you'd say button.setID. And you need to give it some unique ID. So it's up to you to make sure that these IDs are unique. So you can do something like define them at the top of your file or maintain a counter so you never have two IDs that are the same thing. But this is just going to be a primitive integer.
And does it matter whether you do that, for example,
so does it matter if you add the IDs before or after? The ID needs to be added before your code tries to reference it. So best practice is after I do this button equals new button, that's where I would say button.setID. Usually adding it to the layout is the last thing we want to do. So we want to create the elements, set their attributes, attach any event handlers, and then we want to add it to the layout. That's usually the general progression as far as organizing your code goes. Yep.
So you're taking this into dynamic GUIs, because as you said, the user's going to get a choice, and we have to, on the fly, determine what it's going to be. You couldn't prep two or three, what are the other GUIs? It's like static with 15 puzzle of 3 and 8 and whatever in advance and just choose them? We really should be aiming at a dynamic way to handle it.
So the question is, could we do this statically? Per the spec, you're only allowed one activity. So kind of the best way to do that would be to do this dynamically. Right. I mean, you're going to need to be using a dynamic GUI when you populate it with tiles anyway. So even if you have different layouts for each puzzle, that just has your layouts, your tables populated, you're going to need to be working with GUI elements when you're moving tiles around anyway. So this is something we need to take a look at. So we know how to attach event handlers already. Once we have this Java button created, we can just call setOnClickListener on the element itself. So in this case, this function is going to take one argument. So it's just going to be the actual view that was tapped. So if we attach this to a button, this argument in setOnClickListener is going to be a button. Now once we have this button, or in this case just a generic view, if we call getID, that'll return the ID we set it, which is equivalent to what r.id.button would have been. So there's some other functions that we can take a look at once we have these Java GUI elements. So the first is getParent. So if you have a button within a linear layout and you call getParent on the button, you're going to get back the linear layout that's containing that button. So that's potentially useful. If all of your tiles are in a different layout, you'll need to get from tile to another tile somehow. Now, once you have that layout via getParent or whatever, you can call getChildCount, and that's going to give you the number of elements that are contained within the layout. That's potentially useful because there's another function called getChildAt that's going to take an index. So if you say getChildAt0, it's going to take the first child of whatever element you have as your layout. So if you try to call getChildAt an index that's greater than the number of child count, you're probably going to run into an issue. So as we saw this add view already, so if we have a layout or we have any other GUI element, we can call add view to add a subview to that. So this is the equivalent of making a child element in XML, so within the tags for, say, a linear layout. We can also remove a view two different ways. The first is to pass it the actual object to remove. So if we got a button and then we got that button's parent, we can just call remove view and pass it the actual button. We can also do a remove view at. So if all we have is the ID of the button, we can just pass that, not the ID of the button, the index of the button. So we know the button is the second child of the linear layout. We can remove view at 2, and that'll remove the second element from the layout. Yep?
Does remove mean causes that space to be blank now, like removing these buttons in our puzzle?
Yes, that's exactly what it means. So remove means it's going to take it from the layout, and it's just going to take it off the screen. There's going to be no more button. So we'll take a look at an example, and maybe that'll become a little more clear. So here we have a very simple app. I'm actually just going to fire up the emulator while I go through the code, since the emulator takes a while to load. So you notice here, I'm declaring two IDs right off the bat. So this says that I know that I'm going to be creating some dynamic GUI elements, so I need to give them unique IDs. So here I've just defined two numbers, which I know will not be the IDs of any other GUI elements. So here, I'm creating two linear layouts. One is called top, and one is called bottom. So now, right after I create the element, I'm calling setID, and I'm passing it either top ID or bottom ID, which is just an integer. It's in all capital letters, just to remind me that it's a constant. This final qualifier means that I can't ever modify this value because I really wouldn't want to, because I wouldn't want to change the ID. So this final just says if you ever try to modify this value, the compiler is going to yell at you. So now I'm going to create two buttons. So instead of just creating them like that, we can also create dynamic GUI elements in, say, a for loop. So here I'm creating a new button, and I'm calling setText. So this is the equivalent of changing the Android colon text attribute of the button. This takes one argument, and that's just the string. So in this case, I'm going to have two buttons. One is going to say button 0, and one is going to say button 1, because I is going for 0 in the first iteration, and then it's going to be 1. So now I'm setting the onClick listener. So before we had looked at this anonymous inner class way of setting an onClick listener, and now we're going to take a look at this way. So the anonymous inner class is actually slightly inefficient. I'd prefer it stylistically, but it's actually to consume more memory than doing it this way because Android has to create a whole nother object. So we'll see this function next. But before we do that, we're just going to add the button to either the top view or the bottom view. So we're going to make sure the first button we create is in the top view, and the second button we create is in the bottom view. So now if we were to just run the code, and there'd be no code after this, our layout would still be blank, right? Because we haven't actually added anything to our root layout. So we already have a linear layout in our layout folder. So we just have this single linear layout. It has an ID of root layout because it's the kind of the root, the first element in our GUI. So now once I have these two linear layouts, both of which have a button, we need to actually add those linear layouts to the device. So to do that, we're just going to get the root layout using the syntax we've seen before. So we're just going to call find view by ID. And because this is in our XML file, we can just say r.id.rootLayout, just like we've seen. And now we're just calling add view twice. Once for top, once for bottom. So now this single add view call is going to add both the layout and all the children of the layout. So it's going to add the top layout and then both of the buttons. So here is our function. Yeah?
So is it fair to say you did choose XML just like the first basic one? After that, you're dynamically feeding more into it?
Yes. So I did. I have XML for kind of the start off, and then I'm feeding into it. I don't have to do that if I were to just set the content view. As you've seen in lecture, you can just set the content view to a text view or something. Then I don't even have to have this root layout. This is just kind of a reminder that we can still work with XML and Java at the same time. It's not exclusive. Is there another question? OK. So you'll notice here that I'm just saying set onClick listener this. And so the argument for set onClickListener has to be some object that implements a function called onClick. So if I define this function called onClick, this activity is now a valid object that can handle the setOnClickListener. So here I'm just going to display a toast that's going to give us the button's ID. So you'll notice here that the argument to onClick is going to be a view. So in this case, it's going to be the button we tapped. So if I call v.getID, I'm going to get one of the numerical IDs that was set. So in this case, it was either 0 or 1 because I just set the ID as the value of I. And so after that, we're going to get the parent layout of that button. So if we call get parent, we're going to get the containing layout. And then if we call remove view from that parent on the button we just grabbed, we're going to take the button off the screen. So one more thing. In addition to defining onClick up here, we also have to say implement this view.onClickListener. So this is a Java interface. By saying we implement view.onClickListener, we're telling the compiler that there is some method inside of this class called onClick, so you don't have to worry about compiling with this as the onClickListener. So if we take a look at this app, so here are both my buttons. You'll notice that they say button 1 and button 2. If I click either one of them, it's going to say you clicked button 0, and then it's going to completely remove it. And then I have another button here, so if I tap that, it's going to say you clicked button 1, and then it's going to remove it. So everything there was added with Java code, no XML except for that root layout. Yep? Yeah?
So the concept of remove, we just saw it. It comes out of the little arrangement you've got. The other one snaps up because it's now taking that position.
Right. So the reason it snapped up is because there's no more layout there. We remove the entire layout. Yeah, so if a layout's blank, it's not going to occupy any space. So if we have a layout there, there's just nothing in it, so it's going to snap up to take its place.
So if you want to preserve space, you have to populate it with something that's transparent.
Right, so if you want to preserve space, you could populate it with something transparent, or you can make sure that, in this case, we're just swapping things, and we're never kind of removing it. As soon as you remove something, we immediately add something, so we don't get that weird. Mm-hmm. Yep? So if you were to press two things at the same time, then they're effectively going to try to fire at the same time. So it's kind of going to be one doing some code and the other doing some code. So there's no In multi-threaded programming, that's kind of what happens. You're snapping back and forth between two threads. So if you tap two things at once, they're both going to try to fire.
So if there's a reason the one has an application where a person could press two things at the same time, you have to detect that yourself?
So if you wanted to have an application with kind of multi-touch, that Android has special cases for multi-touch and gestures and pinch zoom and things like that, which we haven't taken a look at yet. Only because we only need to handle single taps for this app. So if you have a linear layout with three things, then everything should probably snap over. So if you have a linear layout with three buttons in it, you remove the middle one, it should snap over. We can take a look at that if we have time afterwards just to make sure that actually happens. All right. So finally, we need to populate some dynamic image list. So as we looked at in lecture 4, we can use a list adapter for that. So at the end of lecture 4, one of the source code examples, I think it's activity 10 or something like that, has the source code example for how this works. But just a general overview for creating a list adapter. First, you're going to need to define what a list item looks like. So that file is going to be placed in res layout. So Dan has an XML file called custom menu item, and that can contain view elements. In this case, Dan's just contains a single text view. Then from your Java code, you want to create an array adapter object. And you're going to pass it the layout, the special layout that you've created. And after you've created your array adapter, then you can call setListAdapter from your activity. And that's going to say that we want our activity to just be a list. And then we can add it to the view, just like we'd add anything else to the view. So once we've added it, if we call getListView, that's going to return that dynamic image list, or not necessarily images, but the dynamic list we just added. And then we can call this callback called setItemClickListener. So just like before, we worked with set on click listener. The callback for touching an item in an array adapter list or list adapter, is going to be called set on click set on item click listener. And so you want to work with that just as if it were set on click listener. So one of the big kind of daunting things in this problem set is getting from this background image to this bunch of small images on tiles. So if you might have tried to Google this, you'll notice that Google is exceedingly helpful because its top results include breakup quotes from the Android market as well as statistics of breakup on SMS. So that might not have been so helpful, so hopefully this is a bit more helpful. Just to keep in mind the corner cases when you're designing your bitmap breaker upper, you need to make sure you consider all of these cases. If someone feeds in an image that's smaller than an end puzzle board, it shouldn't break. Or larger than an end puzzle board, it shouldn't break. We also need to handle images with portrait or landscape orientation, as well as the simplest case, which is just going to be a square orientation. So when you're testing, you probably want to test each of these five images to make sure that they're all still displaying correctly. Yep?
Once the image is broken up, we would probably need to make sure that no two segments look the same.
So once an image is breaking up, we probably need to make sure no two segments look the same. That is technically true, but not required on this problem set. But that is, if in the real world, that would actually be a very useful addition. That's true, though. We don't require that, in case you thought you had to. So, what's that? Right. So, but the issue is if we're assigning a single digit to each of these tiles, then it would technically be unsolved. So there are many ways to handle that. We don't have to account for that in this problem set, though. Okay. So Android has a class called bitmap, which is going to work with bitmap images. So although it's called bitmap, it actually is going to work with images that are JPEGs, PNGs, GIFs, or actual bitmaps. So the way of creating a bitmap is a little counterintuitive and a tiny bit buried in the documentation. But instead of just using a bitmap constructor, we have this class called bitmap factory. So this is kind of a Java design pattern that you may have encountered. But this bitmap factory has a static method called decodeResource. So we don't need to create a new bitmap factory. But basically, we can just call this method on the class without instantiating the class. It's what's called a static method. So it takes two arguments. The first is just some resources bundle. which we don't need to worry about. We can just call get resources, and that's going to be the first argument for a decode resource. The second is going to be the ID of some drawable. So we can get that with r.drawable and then dot our image file name without the extension. So once we load in that large bitmap, we need to handle first the case that it's too big or too small for the screen. So once we have a bitmap and we have it stored in some object called bitmap, we can call bitmap.createScaledBitmap. So this is another static method, so we don't need to instantiate a new bitmap. This is just calling it from the class. So the first argument is going to be the bitmap that we loaded via our bitmapfactory.decode resource. And then you can give the image a desired width and a height, and Android is going to scale it to that exact width and height. This filter you could just set as false because we don't need to do anything additional to the image other than scale it. However, you can't just scale it to fit the device because the spec requires that you maintain the aspect ratio of the image. So we need to make sure that the width and the height are scaled by different factors. So maintaining the aspect ratio is kind of the equivalent of resizing an image by dragging the diagonal. You notice that kind of the width and the height change so that the aspect ratio stays the same and the image is not distorted or anything like that. So after we have a nice resized image that maintained our aspect ratio, then we need to make sure that it's square. So to crop an image, we have this other function called create bitmap. So there's no scaled in there. We can just say create bitmap. So our first argument is going to be an already existing bitmap. Then we're going to give it an x and a y. So this is going to be the origin, or the top left, from where we're going to start cropping. And then we're going to give it a width and a height. And so these are going to be the dimensions of the cropped image. So using this, you can basically crop from any point in the image and create any size rectangle using the width and the height arguments. So any questions so far? We'll take a look at an example of this to see what this produces. Yep? So that's next, actually. How do we find the width and the height of the screen? It's right here. So to do that, Android has a special class called DisplayMetrics. And this DisplayMetrics object contains things like the width of the screen in pixels, the height of the screen, the density of the screen. And so to do this, we can just call getResources, which is a function of an activity, then call getDisplayMetrics, and then it has properties like pixel height and pixel width, which will return an integer that is the screen size. So just a caveat when you're working with bitmaps, and if you're working with particularly large bitmaps, these things get pretty memory intensive pretty fast. And so if your Android device runs out of memory, it's going to throw an out of memory error exception. And so we can use try catch blocks to avoid that, to respond accordingly, so we don't try to blow up our device. Also, once we're done with our image, we want to call the recycle method. And this is basically going to garbage collect the bitmap, so it's not in memory anymore. So we want to call this method as soon as we're done with a bitmap. So if our scaling process takes multiple steps and we end up creating multiple bitmap objects, we want to recycle them as soon as we no longer need them. Is there a question? Yeah?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's going to be four slides back on the bitmaps. What about bitmap decode resources, passing in the resources are, and then your bullet get resources parentheses. So that's the activity has that available to just hand it everything to do with these kinds of resources that are available? Is that what's being passed in here?
Yeah, so this thing that's being passed in here is just like a resources object that's already defined in the activity class. So when you extend activity, you've gained this method called getResources. So you could also say this.getResources, typing the this dot. I do that all the time just so Eclipse can autocomplete for me in case I forget what the method is called. But that's all you need to do. You don't even need to worry about what that's doing. So other questions before we take a look at an example?
These methods, for example, create scale bitmap and create bitmap, do they return a new bitmap?
Yes, both of these methods, create bitmap and create scaled bitmap, are going to return a new bitmap.
And so once you've done that, it's safe to recycle the original one?
So once we've done that, it's safe to recycle the original one because we now have two bitmap objects in memory, only one of which we need. So let's put all this together and take a look at an example. Okay, so first, I've added a bitmap image to my res drawable, and I just have this puzzle0.jpg. So the problem spec mentions that all of the images, you can expect them to say puzzle underscore and then an integer from 0 to 10, and it'll have the file extension JPEG. So you notice that the first thing I do is surround my entire code in a try-catch block. So we're catching this out-of-memory error, and we should probably handle it better than this. So you could display a message to the user saying, your bitmap's too big, or recycle the bitmap and ask the user for another one, or many different ways you can respond to that. But that's probably not the best way. So here, we're first creating this big background image. So we're calling decode resource on this.getResources, and then r.drawable.puzzle0. So from this background bitmap, we're going to crop the image. So we're creating another bitmap called cropped, and we're calling createBitmap. Now the source bitmap is going to be the one we just loaded, called background. And so these four arguments, you'll remember, are the x and y coordinates of the origin, a width, and a height. So I'm going to start cropping from the top left of my image, where 0, 0 is, and I'm going to go 100 pixels to the right and 100 pixels down. So that's going to return a bitmap that matches those specifications. So you'll notice that I no longer need that background bitmap, so I recycle it so I don't run out of memory. Now I want to display that bitmap on my device. So I could do this in XML, but I'm just doing it in Java in the spirit of dynamic GUIs. So I'm going to create a new image view object. So we're just passing it the context, which we can just say is this activity. And now the method setImageBitmap takes a bitmap as an argument, and it's going to display the bitmap within the image view. So now you'll remember that our device is still blank because we haven't actually added anything to our root layout. So we're saying this find view by ID, and I have this same thing. It's just a single linear layout. It has an ID of root underscore layout, and then we're adding it. So next, kind of unrelatedly, we're just going to randomly display the device's width. So here I'm saying this get resources, get display metrics, and then I can just use this property called width pixels. And so this is just going to be the integer of how many pixels wide the screen is. So that I'm just displaying a toast, which the message is going to be the screen width as a string. So you can actually just create a toast in one line, which is kind of cool, because we can keep chaining all these methods together. Yep?
Good question.
Sure.
Two or three lines up. So the casting linear layout on that r.id XML thing, that's sort of what turns it into the Java. Is that basically what that's doing now?
So this cast here is kind of important. So this find view by ID returns a view object. So linear layout is a subclass of view. So what that means is that linear layout has some methods in it that are not necessarily defined by a view object. However, we know that this view object is also a linear layout object because we just happen to know that this is a linear layout in our XML. So by casting it to a linear layout, and as we've done previously, we casted things to buttons, we tell the compiler that we can use methods that are not necessarily defined by view, but by the linear layout subclass of view. So that's why we're casting. That is, it is necessary. In languages like C, a lot of times it's not strictly necessary to do that. In this case, it is very necessary. So let's run this app, and after all that, obtain somewhat of an underwhelming output. So there we go. My original image was just that Extension School logo, and now I have a 100 by 100 pixel box. And not sure if you noticed the toast, so we'll run that one more time. But there it says 320, which is the width of my screen.
Now, if your original image had been less than 100 by 100, it would scale it up, yes? No, it wouldn't, because its prop would return something with a little piece of an image and then fill in the rest of it.
So the question was, what if we try to crop beyond the bounds of our image? I believe it would just give you as much as possible, and it might throw a warning in the debug console like you tried to crop too big. But you can get the dimensions of a bitmap once you load it with get height and get width from this bitmap object. And so that could be a corner case you check for to make sure that you're not worrying about it. But when you're actually implementing this, you probably want to scale first so that you make sure you're not trying to crop outside of the scale. Yep? Yeah?
So now, if I remove the image view from the linear layout, will the cropped bitmap
So if we were to just remove the layout, will the bitmap be recycled? I don't believe it would. It's always safest to try to recycle it just in case. I don't think it would be automatically recycled, but maybe it is. It's all depending on the garbage collection policy. Like, it might eventually be, but it's always safest to call recycle as soon as you possibly can. Yep?
What are the bad effects of not recycling?
So what are the bad effects of not recycling? So if we load a bunch of bitmaps in at the same time, your phone, which doesn't have a lot of memory, a lot of RAM, it's eventually going to run out because we need to hold the entire bitmap in RAM. So if you have, you know, a 2 megabyte bitmap and you have, you know, 100 of them, that's probably eventually going to run out of RAM on your device, so it'll slow down and things will start to crash, and eventually the Android system itself is going to yell at you for having way too much RAM and probably shut you down. So the whole thing is in a try-catch for no reason, actually, other than it was simpler to do it that way. So our catch really doesn't need to apply anymore after this point. But still, you never know. Other things could be going on in the device with your bitmap. So there's no strict reason why we put it here, but as long as it's there somewhere. So usually you could probably just contain it to your actual bitmap operations. But this scope of try-catch would be pretty reasonable for a project too. Other questions on bitmaps? All right, so let's move on to saving state. So per this project specification, we need to make sure we're saving the state of the board, the number of moves that have been made on the board, and the difficulty. So recall from a few weeks back, we went over the life cycle of an activity. Now remember that on pause is called whenever the activity is removed from the foreground state. You also have this on stop and on destroy, but those aren't guaranteed to be called as soon as the activity is sent to the background. So they're not the best choices to use when you're saving activity state. There's also a method called on resume, which is called whenever the activity is put into the foreground state, whether it be opening up for the first time or getting rid of a pop-up so it's back in the foreground. So that's going to be the best place to retrieve our state. So in order to save our state, we're going to need to override these methods. However, we need to make sure that we call the original definition of onPause after we're done. So to do that, we're going to call super.onPause. So this is going to call what onPause would have been if we didn't override it. So your application will crash if you don't do this. So this isn't one of those things that we can knock you for, even though you thought your project was perfect. You will not be able to get back into your app if you don't call these. So first, let's go over retrieving state. So we have this object called shared preferences, and that's going to allow us to save the state of an app. So to retrieve the shared preferences object associated with your app, we're just going to call get preferences, and then we're going to pass it this mode, which could be kind of analogous to reading a file, so you can say read, or if you just want a write or anything like that. So once we have the shared preferences object, we have these methods like get boolean, get string, get int, which are going to do just what they sound like they're going to do, and they're going to return the value of the key value pair associated with the string name. So if I have a string called state stored in my shared preferences, if I would pass the string state as this first argument. The second argument is going to be what the method should return if there's no key found. So if I try to retrieve something called state and there is no key called state, then I want to pass some sentinel value into this value. So if I gave it something like a -1, which could be impossible in some cases for like the number of moves, then we could react accordingly, saying if this is equal to -1, then we know that there's no state saved, and if it's not, we know that this is actually a valid state. So kind of a handy little thing getting state can do. So in order to save state, we're going to use a different object, the shared preferences.editor. So in order to create one of these objects, we're going to say get preferences, we're going to give it a mode again, and then we're going to call the edit method. So that's going to return a shared preferences editor. So now, just like we had get boolean, get int, and get string, we have put boolean, put string, put int, etc. So again, this name is just going to be the key of your key value pair. The value this time is going to be what you're actually saving as that key. So once we have all these puts, we need to call commit, which is actually going to write everything to the preferences object and effectively save the state. So if we don't call commit, we're actually not saving any state. We're just kind of writing it to this object, and then nothing happens. So let's take a look at an example of state. So here we have first our onResume function. Actually, let's take you through the layout really fast so you know what's going on. So here we just have a linear layout and then a single edit text object. So I could have created this in Java. In this case, we just have it in XML. It has an ID of edit text. So we can access it via r.id.editText. So you notice here, it's especially important to convert it to an edit, to cast it to an edit text object, because we're eventually going to call this setText method. So if we didn't cast it, we'd get an error from the compiler saying that the setText method doesn't exist. And that's because you can't set a text on an arbitrary view. You can only do that on certain ones, including the edit text. So now we're going to create our shared preferences object. So we're just going to say get preferences, and this is just a mode. This mode private is going to give us both read and write permission. And so now we're going to restore the value. In this case, I'm just storing a single key value pair. The key is going to be called chars. And I want this to return a zero if chars has not already been defined. So with this value, I'm just setting the text of this edit text by converting this integer to a string via string.valueOf. That's just the Java way of getting from an integer or a float or whatever to a string. And now I'm calling super.onResume. So if I remove this, I'm going to get a nice pop-up that says your app closed unexpectedly. So now the... Yep?
Sorry, could you give us another word of context? Why were we in onResume? The user is just in something instead of text box. What is resume about this?
Oh, sure. So what this app is going to do, not something strictly your app might want to do, but the user is going to type into some text box. When the user loads that up again, it's going to be replaced with how many characters were in the text box. So not something strictly useful, but we can see how we're doing that inside of this on pause. So again, this on resume is going to be called any time that we're brought to the foreground. So even if the app was stopped and it hasn't ever been started before, this on resume is still going to be called because it's called whenever an app is brought into the foreground. So the name is a little deceptive in that it'll resume even if it was never paused.
Mm-hmm.
So this mode private is a constant that's defined by Android for us. If you look at the documentation, you can see some other values. So it's defined in the android.content.context.modePrivate. So you'll notice that up here, we are importing that. So we're importing this android.content.sharedPreferences because we're going to be using the shared preferences object down here. So some other ones include, so we also have something like mode append, mode private, mode readable, mode writable. Mode private is just going to be the general case of I'm writing or reading data. So we're just usually just going to pass it this mode private. And it'll be fine. So in this on pause, we're creating, first we're getting this preferences again. So we're calling get preferences. Here's the mode private again. And now from that preferences, we're creating an editor for it. So we have the shared preferences.editor. Now we're calling the edit method on those preferences. I could have also have just said this.getPreferences.edit. This would have done the same thing. So now we're calling putInt. Our key is going to be chars. And the value is going to be the length of the text box. So how many characters are actually in the text box. So I'm saying editText.getText, which is going to return a char sequence. And that char sequence has a method called length, which returns the number of characters in the char sequence. So now I'm calling commit to actually save the state. And finally, I'm ending with the super.onPause, which says do whatever you're going to do before I overrode your method. So let's run this. So here it already has a value because I was making sure it worked beforehand. So if we start typing in some text, and then we quit the app by clicking on the home screen. Now if we go back into the app, so if we click the launcher and we open this app back up, you'll notice that it's now the number of characters that I had typed in. Now, this will also work no matter how I get out of the app. So if I click the back button, it's still going to save the number of characters I had, which is now 16, where I had 17 before. So if using this on pause, make sure that no matter how the user gets out of this activity, whether it be by opening a new activity, by answering a phone call, by hitting the home button, that we're going to make sure that our state is totally saved. Yep?
And in terms of state, are we talking about exactly how the board looked at the time, or as well as which difficulty setting they had chosen?
So when we say state, we're referring to everything possible we can save. There's a list in the spec that does include the board state, the difficulty, and the number of moves made. Maybe among other things, but those are the three major ones that you need to worry about. Yep?
Is there any other way to save or really use the preferences there that you just showed us?
So the preferences is probably the easiest way. We're going to take a more in-depth look at saving state in the next lecture. I just wanted to give you a quick high-level overview of what it's going to look like so you can get started on that part if you wanted to before Tuesday. Yep?
Is the order important when super pause and super zoom is called? Because I know it's called afterwards.
Yeah, so the order, it is best practice to always have the super afterwards just so that maybe something beforehand will mess up what we're doing afterwards. So it's just best to call it afterwards. Just kind of best practice. There are probably some situations where it could go anywhere, but it's good to be consistent in both of them and just put it in the same place. Yes?
What happens if the emulator crashed? Are we supposed to...
So if you want to see what this looks like if we don't call on resume. So if we run this... We're just going to get this. Sorry, the application crashed. Please try again. You click force close, and you're back to the launcher. So that's all that'll happen if you don't have the super on resume or super on pause.
Well, I meant more like, do we need to handle for the state before the emulator crashed for whatever reason?
So do we need to handle state before the emulator crashes?
If
the emulator crashes. So I'm not sure if there's a crash if you're going to have a guarantee the on pause is called. The emulator shouldn't crash, really. If it does, maybe there is some like on pause will still be called. But this is the way which you're going to need to handle state. You just need to handle the case in which the user goes away from the activity, and hopefully the emulator shouldn't crash while you're making your app. Other questions? If not, we'll take a quick overview at menus. Oh, sure, yeah.
Are there ways to save for complex objects?
So you can check out the documentation for the full list of puts and gets. Those are the basic ones. And if you're creative with how you're storing your string, then you can probably store everything in a single string. Remember, something like JSON or even XML is cross-language, so if you want to even use JSON as a representation of your state, you could do that. You wanted to store it in XML, you could store that as a string. But the full list of everything that you can put is on the documentation page. Other questions? Okay, so really quickly, just a high-level overview of these menus. So in Android, unlike in iOS, there's a dedicated menu button. And so when you press that menu button, you'll get a different menu depending on what app you're in. So we can define menus via XML or Java again. So if we're using XML, then we're going to put our XML files in res/menu, where a menu element is going to have multiple item children. You can also use the group element to group items. So we're going to access this menu just like we have been always, just r.menu and then dot the file name. So if you had a menu called appmenu.xml, we would just say r.menu.appmenu. So there are two primary callbacks you need to be worried about. The first is onCreate options menu. So this callback is going to be fired whenever the user actually presses the menu button. And it's going to pass it some menu object that you can work with. Next is the onOptions item selected, which is going to be fired whenever the user selects an item in the menu. So instead of getID, we need to call item.getItemID. And that's going to be the ID that we'd normally be using with r.id. So Fun fact, Android has a lot of fun built-in icons. You can check them all out at this cool little icon explorer. Most of the icon menu icons are going to have the prefix IC menu. And the attribute to get one of these built-in system icons is going to be at Android colon drawable and then slash one of these names. So just really quick, what a menu would look like. We'll take a much more in-depth look at the different types of menus in lecture, but I just wanted to give you a really fast overview so you could get started on this part. So here in my res folder, I have res menu, and I just have this options menu.xml. I could name it whatever I wanted. Here I have a menu where I have five different options. I notice that I'm using this at Android drawable, and then these are all constants that are defined in the Android API for us, and you can check them out with that URL. So in our Java file, we're defining both of these callbacks. So on create options menu, we're going to create our menu with something called an inflator. So we're going to, whenever the button is pressed, we're going to inflate that menu, so make it pop up from the bottom. And so this is just going to actually display the menu. In this case, r.menu.optionsmenu, which is the XML file we just looked at. And finally, this on options item selected, this will be fired whenever an item is pressed. So we can get the item that was pressed with get item ID, and then we can compare that to this r.id.option1. So basically, this way we can figure out what item has been pressed, and then we can just show a toast depending on what happened. So what this app will do very simple. If we press this menu button here, this is where it is in the emulator. It looks different on different devices. If we click this menu, then this is the menu that's going to pop up. You'll notice that Android takes care of arranging the menu items for us, and these are some fun built-in icons in the Android API, like there's a man on the moon, and you selected option one. So we're going to take a more in-depth look at both menus and saving state in lecture on Tuesday, but that's just a quick overview, enough to get you going on the project. So good luck on the first Android Staff's Choice project, and we'll see you on Tuesday.